Hello, my name is Carden Irakoze. I was born in Rwanda. I grew up in Tanzania, but I'm from Burundi. And this is my story.
I'll try to do better.
No, that's good.
You're listening to Please Be Reasonable, where we seek to speak humbly and passionately about things that matter and things that don't.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Please Be Reasonable. I'm your co-host, Sam.
And I'm your co-host, Josh.
And you just heard from Carden, who you know, right, Josh?
Yes.
If you can't tell, today we're going to be talking about refugees, kind of a theology of welcoming the refugee or not so much. So we're going to be talking about that today, and interspersed throughout our discussion, we're going to have some clips from an interview Josh did with Carden talking about his experience as a refugee. So I think it'll be cool.
I think that'll help us keep the discussion from becoming too abstract and talking about faceless statistics and numbers, and kind of remind us of the real people that are affected by some of these discussions.
Absolutely, man. So how you doing? Before we jump into it, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Had to do some restoring on my wife's iMac last week, which wasn't fun, but it's mostly fixed.
Yeah. What? Hers is old, right?
Yeah, it's like 7 years old, still kicking.
Okay. Rock and roll, man. Dude, we're recording on my 2005 MacBook, so.
Yeah.
First generation Intel, so still kicking.
Old school.
So I got to do something kind of cool. I do want to share real quick before we jump in. Kim and I got to go to another release party.
Another one.
Yeah, man, another EP release party.
I feel some deja vu here.
I know. Like
intro
we're
episodes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're so cool. We get invited to local EP release parties. A friend of Kim and I's from Red Tree, a guy named Travis Page, put out an EP, and it is so good, Josh. Josh, it's so good. Josh, it's so good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very like blues, rock, singer, songwriter. And it's just, oh my gosh. I wish I had some clips ready to play, but maybe I'll post a couple online or something. But it's a guy, Travis Page, is one of our worship guys out at the Maplewood Church. And he wrote the entire EP. In a season of faith deconstruction for him.
Mm.
And so it goes through some pretty hard topics. I mean, he has a song called Family that's really good, where he talks basically about leaving the church and then coming back to faith. But then like he has this line where he's like, I'm back, but I have some questions you got to own up to and answer, and asks some really hard questions about our doctrines of hell and the church's understanding of homosexuality and some stuff like that. And so it was really cool, really cool to be a part of. They did the release party at the Gaslight Lounge. Have you been there?
No.
It's kind of in the Hill area.
Okay.
But they have a recording studio and a bar kind of connected together, a bar kind of restaurant, mostly a bar. But so they did like some acoustic stuff and some covers to open up the night, and people were just hanging out. And then they went into the studio and played through the album live and recorded it. And everyone who got to go got like a free copy of the live recording.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cool. Like it was really cool.
Was it cool, Sam?
Yeah, it was just so good.
And good.
So Logan, our Kingly buddy, Logan Miller, he played guitar on the EP for Travis. And the dude just let loose. And like some songs that were supposed to be like 3 minutes long ended up like 7 minutes long with like the guitar just going, and it was so good. Such a pleasant experience, man.
All right.
So you should check them out. They're on iTunes and Spotify.
Say the name again for all our listeners that are just ready to Google us right now. And
Travis Teal Page is his name, and it is excellent. Excellent music. Local St. Louis musicians making good stuff, so we always want to support that.
That's right. So, yeah, today we're going to be talking about refugees, and
yes,
that has become a politicized topic, brought to you by
Aldi Root Beer.
and there's you know, some divide between Christians on, you know, what our government's policy should be as far as welcoming refugees. And I think there's a lot of people that kind of generally have this welcoming stance, and, you know, see as if anybody is opposed to this, then they must be led by fear, and there's no real reason to be afraid of doing what we're obviously called in the Bible to do.
Yeah.
And then you kind of have this other side of folks that are a little more hesitant and are a little concerned that maybe some of that's misapplying some scripture, and that there's kind of some naivety there about some concerns, maybe related to Islam, the big elephant in the room.
Yeah.
And so we're going to try to unpack some of that and try to see what the Bible says and see what kind of things we can talk about some of these different issues.
Yeah, for sure. Before we jump in, let's go back to Cardin and hear about his experience in the refugee camp. You want to do that?
Let's do it.
Cool.
Refugee camp was it was crazy, but at the same time, we had each other, so that was peaceful. So the UN would provide food for us, but they'll give you food. They say, hey, this food is supposed to last you 2 weeks. But most of us, it was only a week. So you had to find a way to make food for the next week before you can receive the next meal. it was crazy. And there was a lot of killing. People coming into the camp, killing people. Hospitals were bad. I remember you could go to the hospital for a whole week without seeing a doctor. I remember one time I went to the hospital. First day, they didn't get to me. Second day, they didn't get to me. Third day, they didn't get to me. I just got better. I just went. I just got better. So I never went back to. So I was sick. So I got better going to the hospital every day. I was there at 7 o'clock, going home at 5. 7 o'clock, going home at 5. Going 7 o'clock, going home at 5. For 3 days. The people would die just laying down over there. So just dying. So it was crazy. So the food was crazy. Just, I remember walking 10 miles to go get firewood because we couldn't cut wood in our camp. We had to go travel 10 miles, go find firewood. In the forest, people were getting killed. That's a whole other different story. People finding dead bodies in the forest.
Yeah, so if you're not familiar with some of these processes, refugees are people who have fled their homeland due to war or terrorism or persecution or some other calamity. And then typically what the powers of the world do trying to handle these crises is set up refugee camps in various places, try to provide some kind of real rudimentary food and shelter while, you know, everybody else kind of figures out what to do with them. And sometimes the conditions in refugee camps can be pretty rough. But the question is, if we, you know, if some people, their decisions made to try to bring some of them to another country to start a new life, how should we feel about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And obviously, you know, as Christians, we want to start with what the Bible says. And the Bible doesn't really use the word refugee like we do. But there's a lot in the Bible about how to treat foreigners or people from another land that come into your land.
Yeah.
And some really fascinating stuff. The Old Testament talks a lot about the sojourner, who was living with the Israelites and how the Israelites were to treat them. And God told the Israelites, you shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. And he speaks multiple times throughout the Old Testament in the law about not oppressing foreigners because you were foreigners in Egypt, and making that connection there. And he even goes farther than just saying don't oppress them. He groups them in with orphans and widows and other needy people, and saying, you know, when you bring tithes of your produce in, bring it so that the foreigners, the fatherless, and the widows who live in your towns may come and eat and be satisfied, so that the Lord may bless you. That's in Deuteronomy 14. In Leviticus 23, he talks about when you reap the harvest of your land, don't gather every little thing, leave them for the poor and for the sojourner.
Yeah, yeah.
And we know that Ruth was a famous example of someone who took advantage of that practice.
Yeah.
And God even elevates the sojourner to such a level that he says in Leviticus 19, you shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. So there's kind of this idea that the sojourner, the foreigner, or the alien, some translations translate the word, was they shouldn't be oppressed. They were at risk of vulnerability. They were to make sure to be provided for and even, you know, have the same rights as the native Israelite.
Yeah. But Josh,
yes,
that was a different time, and those are different people.
Yeah.
Those weren't ISISes.
That's, yeah. So what's really interesting is how Jesus...
I love that you just sort of just like, yeah, I'm not even going to respond to that. That's too dumb.
No. I'm segueing it here because it's really interesting how Jesus connects that with what he says in the New Testament.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I mean, most of the blatant language about how you treat the sojourner, the foreigner, the refugee comes from the Old Testament, which is one of the arguments some people use to say, like, hey, this doesn't necessarily apply to our situation today as believers.
Right. So, you know, you have Luke 10, a lawyer stands up to Jesus and says, teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And he says, well, what is written in the law? How do you read it? And he answers, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength and all your mind and your neighbor and yourself. And Jesus says, you've answered correctly. Do this and you will live. But then he says, and who is my neighbor? And that's when Jesus tells the famous story of the Good Samaritan. And I think we lose how radical that story was.
Oh yeah.
In our modern
Absolutely.
Context. I did some reading research up on the Jews and the Samaritans in the first century and how, you know, the Samaritans were descendants of certain tribes that had stayed in the land during the exile and intermarried with Gentiles and adopted some pagan practices.
Yeah. They'd essentially like mixed together Judaism and the pagan religions,
and
that were
they
local.
And both groups thought they had the true way to worship God, and they didn't associate with each other. There's even some violence between the groups.
Yeah,
and so like, it would be radical enough if Jesus said if the story was of a Jewish person helping a Samaritan being robbed.
Yeah,
but like to actually make the Samaritan be the helper, like the guy that's part of the wrong religion and this outside group, like that's like super radical.
Yeah. I've heard pastors tell this parable and to try and make a modern connection, but like, let's replace the Samaritan with an ISIS militant. And like, that's the mental cultural connection.
Yeah. Well, but the thing is, when you connect it back to the Old Testament, it's not really a something new. It's this whole idea of love your neighbor as yourself means love the foreigner as yourself.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely
something that was in Leviticus all along. But I think there's also a way that Jesus is kind of expanding it, because now it's not the sojourner who's living with you. It's the foreigner who's not even with you. He's in his own separate place. You know, Jesus went out of his way to spend time with the Samaritans, and, you know, there's this whole idea of Jesus wants to save all people and bring them all together, and tear down the, you know, the hostility between them. And so I think that's pretty neat.
Yeah.
The way, you know, all of us kind of have this natural sinful tendency to turn towards our own group and care about people like us. And, you know, from the beginning of the Bible, when God's commanding the Israelites to be kind to foreigners, through Jesus, you know, challenging the Jews to have a higher view of Samaritans when they view them negatively, you know, God is challenging us to focus outward and to view all humanity as made in His image and deserving of His love.
Yeah, and when you get into how just anti-tribal the gospel actually is, it's pretty intense. I mean, you have the New Testament saying in Christ, there is no Jew or Greek, there's no male or female, no slave or free. I mean, there's this idea. I mean, the Christian is referred to, ironically, in our discussion, as a sojourner, right? Like that we, by being in the world, even though we're citizens of God's kingdom, we're the foreigners.
Yeah.
And so we're not to look at the world through the lens of our cultural tribe, like tribal associations, but rather through the lens of we're part of God's kingdom. We're part of this overarching work that He's doing. And that's, I mean, that's pretty intense. That's a pretty powerful image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when, you know, one common criticism of those who wish to welcome refugees is that a lot of these verses are more for individuals. You know, the quintessential story of, or the quintessential example of Jesus saying, you know, when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me a drink. When I was a stranger, you welcomed me in.
Is that Matthew 24?
Matthew 25. Yeah.
Close.
If
I'd been more than three chapters off, I would have lost my pastor card. So,
well, glad you were only one chapter off. And so, you know, I think it's true. There is definitely an individual component.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, various ways that individual charity has its aspects that can even be, you know, superior to government charity. Different arguments along that nature. At the same time, I also think you could argue that there's just a consistency in God's heart, whether it's at the individual level or the national level, and that immigration in particular is obviously has a national component by definition. And you know, you see biblical examples of characters taking refuge in countries that allowed them.
I think what's the larger picture here that I think is important is to remember, I don't think any believer and any serious theologian is going to argue that the Bible does not absolutely affirm kindness to the foreigner, kindness to the refugee, love your neighbor as yourself. Like I don't think anyone would argue that that is not the overwhelming message of the scripture. Where the discussion comes up, where the nuance comes up, is what is the individual Christian's responsibility to act that out culturally?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the discussion here in America, like you said, the whole national versus personal thing is, okay, so if that's my command as a believer, is it my responsibility to try and impose that on national policy? Or is that just the way I should live? And even then, I think there's nuance of Christians saying, okay, now, can I actually do that? Can I actually live as someone who's loving my neighbor when my neighbor is, you know, actively trying to kill me or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And I have a hard time saying that I love this foreign family as much as my own family if I don't want them to come to my country.
Yeah.
Like, as, like I like there has to be an individual component. Like a nation can't forcibly accept refugees and it be a successful process without individuals who will, you know, come alongside them and help them.
And this is kind of what's happening in Germany a little bit right now, is the government pushed it past what people were excited about, and it's causing problems.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's a strong case for welcoming as a national policy, at least on some level.
Yeah.
As part of that, you know, whole idea of tearing down hostility and turning ourselves outward,
to
the foreigner.
And I think this is probably an important spot to just confess our bias, because both me and you feel pretty strongly, right, that this is like this is an imperative of Scripture. This is something that God desires of His people. And so I think both of us pretty strongly look at the whole refugee issue, and we say, yes, absolutely, our culture, our country, our government should be welcoming of people who are hurting and in need of a safe place. And so obviously that makes it a little harder for us to discuss this. Fairly is not the right word. We just have a bias.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's harder for us to see the other perspective of it, but we're going to try to. And so, call us out on that, on areas where you think we're not representing this other argument well, because we don't want to set up straw men. We don't want to be one-sided.
Yeah. And well, now to help with that, I want to read a little bit from Franklin Graham, who is the leader of Samaritan's Purse, which does a lot of work throughout the world. And he kind of generally takes a more cautious stance on welcoming refugees.
Yeah.
And he posted some thoughts on Facebook on some of these issues. And let me just read you some of what he said and get your thoughts, Sam.
Yeah.
And I'm going to talk in a fake Southern voice like I'm Franklin Graham. As Christians, we are clearly taught in the Bible to care for the poor and oppressed. At Samaritan's Purse, we have been working in the Middle East for over 30 years. We've provided things like food, heaters, blankets, coats, shelter, plastic, and more for tens of thousands of refugees. We opened a 55-bed field trauma hospital in northern Iraq, where we're treating Muslims who are being wounded by other Muslims in the fight over Mosul. But some people seem to have forgotten that the priority of the President of the United States is protecting the Constitution and safety of Americans. We have to be sure the philosophies of those entering our country are compatible with our Constitution. I believe the best way to help is to reach out and help these people in their own countries. We need to pray for political solutions that would bring peace and allow them to return to their homes as they desire. God does tell us to help the stranger and those in need, but God doesn't tell us to expose our cities, homes, and lives to hostile people. Remember, Jerusalem had walls and gates, and when they had a threat, the gates were closed. Many Muslim groups have made no secret of their deep and deadly hatred for this country. There is a fundamental incompatibility between Islam's Sharia law and our Constitution and Bill of Rights.
You see, you can't do the Southern accent. You can't do that.
I can't.
Because, I mean, it's too late. You've done it.
Yeah.
But I just have this stigma. I hear the Southern accent and I'm like, oh, well, that's wrong.
But you're like, you have like this Southern Baptist background.
I know.
So what do you think of that, Sam?
Man, I go back to what you said earlier, right? So I love all the things he's describing that we're doing, but there's something that just seems so cold and heartless about, yeah, I'll help you, I'll take care of you, I'll help provide for your needs, as long as you don't come to my house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, let me say, I think there's some validity to some of that concern. You know, I don't think it makes sense for, you know, they say there's about 65 million refugees in the world right now that have been displaced for various reasons. And, you know, it probably doesn't make sense for every one of those people to be relocated to the United States.
Probably not.
And, you know, it makes sense to help many of them where they are. And, you know, also trying to look at a higher level of trying to come up with a more comprehensive justice. And, you know, so we can hopefully create a situation where they can return to their homes.
Yeah.
At the same time, I would ask the hesitator to consider that, you know, even with some charity, life in a refugee camp is not the life we'd want for ourselves.
Exactly.
And
we just heard that with Cardin, right?
Yeah. Like, and so, you know, if our country has the capacity to accept, you know, even a very small percentage of those refugees and, you know, provide a better life for them and going through a process where we've decided to accept them, you know, if we are to love them as ourselves, then what's the problem with that?
I think the whole problem of the love them where they are solution is that a large number of the refugees, where they are is not home. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing if they're living in an impoverished area that has no access to food or water, education or something like that. And so humanitarian agencies can come in and help the locals build that kind of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. That's one thing, and that's beautiful, and that's I get that. But if home doesn't exist, if home was blown up and ripped apart by war and literally is not there anymore, and you're living in an overcrowded tent city with no hygiene or access to education, the solution is not let's bring some chemical toilets to your tent city. Like, I just feel like that solution falls short,
mm-hmm.
of the reality of some of these refugee camps.
Yeah. You want to maybe play a little more of Cardin's story?
Yeah, let's hear about Cardin's process of getting the visa and getting refugee status and then coming to America and kind of some of the expectations he had versus reality. I think it'll be cool.
I lived in a refugee camp in Tanzania for 12 years. And the U.S. government wanted some refugees from Burundi. They want a certain number. And we were the one of the families who were chosen. So we didn't choose to come. The U.S. chose us. So, but the process was crazy and long.
What do you remember about it?
So in 2005, we had a new president in Burundi. And they said, this president is going to bring peace. and the Tanzania government said he was going to shut down the camp we lived in. So your option was to move to a different camp or to go back home, because we had a new president who brought peace to our country. But my family didn't know where to go. They couldn't go back home because they were driven out by the war, so they couldn't go. They didn't have a home to go back to. So my mom said, we're just going to move to a different camp. So before we were supposed to move, the U.S. government put out a list of people who were chosen to go to America. And my mom went there the first time, just check her name on the list. She didn't find it the first. She said, oh my God, this is crazy. She went there the second time, she found her name on the list. Then we had to go to the, so the process began after you find your name. A month after that, you find your name. We'll go to this office. At first, we're asked our names and age. So we wrote that down, gave it to them. That was the beginning. So we moved to a different camp. The process kept going. It took 2 years, from 2005 to 2007. So some of the questions were asked. They would check your background, who you were, where you came from. There was a lot of stupid questions they'll ask you, like, if America gets attacked, would you fight them? And my mom would say, of course, that's my people then, if I'm there. But the process was long and crazy, taking pictures and all this stuff. They'll ask you a lot of questions for 2 years. There's some people who didn't make it because the backgrounds were bad. They didn't pass the interview. It was a lot of stuff.
So one of the things I love that Cardin said in there, he was talking about the process, right? The interviews to get refugee status and get to the United States. And he said like how they were asking all these different questions. And one of the questions was, if America went to war, would you fight for America, right? And he said, well, of course I would. If I live there, that's my home. And I think that's a piece we miss in some of this refugee discussion is, a lot of these people are coming from a place where their home has been completely and utterly destroyed. And so when we open our doors and we say, come, like, you're welcome, like, come, be here, be safe, have a new home, like, they take that and say, this is a new home, and I want to be a part of this culture. I want to be a part of what you guys do. I want to be an excellent citizen. And I think taking our theological discussion out of it, I think there's something incredibly culturally beneficial about that, mm-hmm. about someone who says, this is a biblical idea, right? Like Romans talks about how it's the kindness of God that leads us to repentance, right? And there's this idea that culturally expressing kindness to someone in a time of need will build an excitement and a loyalty that wouldn't be built otherwise mm-hmm. through other means. In fact, like you asked Cardin at one point specifically, like, do you feel like an American? I thought that was part was really cool. Can I play that real quick?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, do I feel like an American? Of course, it's my country. I feel like an American, but I'm not American yet. I think being an American is a good feeling. It's a good thing because America's the only country that can come. Like we lived in four different countries: Rwanda, Congo, Tanzania, and Burundi. But America's the only country that can come from start from scratch and work our way up. Like, that's the only country you can come for stuff from nothing. Like, other countries you can go, nope. Nope. And you can be a refugee and they can help you. Like, the government, like, American people, they're actually more nice than they think. I mean, they might be nice to other people, to foreigners, but this is the only country that can come and start from scratch. And so being an American is like, I apply for my citizenship. I got my stuff back. They said, I'm going to do my fingerprint on the 17th of this month. So I'm really happy. And the whole world is afraid of me. If you're an American, the whole world is afraid of you. So I'm going to be, everybody's going to be afraid of me. So I can't wait to be an American. So yeah, it's a good feeling.
Yeah, there's this, it's quintessential to what it means to be in America for all of us, you know, as a nation of immigrants, the melting pot.
Absolutely.
You know, most of our ancestors were fleeing persecution or coming here for a better life. And, it's not just something to be nice to do, but it's actually very American to welcome immigrants, to welcome refugees and give them opportunity for a better life.
Do you know, have I ever told you that I'm directly descended from political and religious refugees?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Tinel's came from Huguenots.
Oh, the religious refugees.
Yeah. They were kicked out of France for their religious beliefs and had their property and home seized, and they went to England, and after a while, England was like, you got to leave here too.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's crazy, but legitimately, like, the first Tinels that came over to the colonies at that point came as refugees who'd had their homes and their property and their land seized.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to the new world.
But I want to go back to something that Franklin Graham spoke about, because I think it touches on kind of what is really a major factor in kind of some of the differences of opinion on this. There are those like Franklin Graham who might say, yeah, okay, yeah, we welcome immigrants, we welcome refugees, and all throughout history, that's great, but there's something different about Muslim refugees.
Dun, dun, dun.
And I think the perception of Islam is a very big divider. If you have a perception that the overwhelming majority of Muslims are peaceful and non-threatening and are even fleeing, you know, extreme radical terrorism themselves. And, you know, maybe you have relationships with Muslims, you know some of them, you've heard and read different things. You view most of them as peaceful, and that so a risk of terrorism is kind of just this general risk of, like, you know, we can't avoid it. We shouldn't let fear of it override our clear commands to be loving and welcoming, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah.
There's another perception, though, of that views, there's a perception that if you truly adhere to the Quran, that, you know, it doesn't tolerate freedom of religion, and that, you know, if you allow an influx of Muslims into your country, that you're going to have an increased risk of terrorism, that there's going to be attempts to change your laws to fit their laws, and there's going to be different crimes, and, you know, it's this whole threat to civilization, essentially.
Have you ever studied the Quran much?
Not a whole lot.
So I think part of the problem here is, I know I'm interrupting you, but I think Westerners assume that the Quran essentially points to a specific overarching worldview the same way the scripture does. There's a stream of theology called biblical theology that looks at the overarching story of the Christian scriptures, right? Have you ever heard the whole, like, creation, fall, covenant, like, redemption, consummation mm-hmm. model, that the whole of scripture points to this overarching story, and then because of that points to this singular overarching worldview? I think as Westerners, we assume that other religions operate the same way. But if you look at the Quran is really uniquely structured as a holy book, because essentially it's entirely out of context. It's like if you took all the narratives and sayings and different genres that exist in the Christian scripture, and you chopped it up and then just threw it in like a big bowl and shook it up, and everything is just placed out there. Bits of story, bits of verse, bits of history, bits of theology, bits of sermons, and they're all completely separate from each other out of any kind of chronological or story order. And the result of that is that the Quran, like, it doesn't lead to one singular worldview. Easy to be interpreted and bring different thought processes and different histories and different schools of theology out of it.
Yeah, there's the what they call the hadiths, which, as I understand, are different interpretations and filterings of the Quran and other various statements that are, you know, given different authority by different groups of the variety within Islam that lead to different worldviews about it.
So the assumption that, like, even the statement, like, all Muslims are fill in the blank, is just automatically wrong.
As it is for any group.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And now what I do want to get into more about the specifics of Islam. But as just kind of a backdrop to kind of explain different viewpoints, if that is your perception of what Islam is, or even a part of it is, then you're going to view more welcoming Muslim refugees into your country in a sense of, yeah, it'd be great to help these people, but there's a risk. And, let me make some arguments and see what you think of this, Sam.
Yeah.
If you could make the argument that if you ignore warning signs to take care of yourself, that you can't help others.
Okay.
So, you know, if there's a risk to, if there's a risk to yourself, you know, there, there's a sense of general risk that you can't avoid. You can't totally guarantee something. You don't want to say I'm really not being coherent here. Let me try again.
Yeah, let's.
So there's a general sense of unavoidable risks. Someone might say, I'm not going to go on a mission trip because I can't guarantee that I won't get a disease. So I just can't, I'm just not going to do it. It might be unsafe. It'd be great to help people, but there's a risk I'll get hurt. And then what good would I be to anybody?
Yeah.
Then there's also a sense of a targeted or more specific risks, say during the Ebola outbreak last year in Africa, somebody might say, oh, I'm fine to go, travel and accept those general risks. I'm not afraid of that, but it wouldn't be wise for me right now to specifically go to this country where there's an Ebola outbreak. Let's let official doctors and people handle those things, and I'll just send money or I'll do, I'll wait or go somewhere else or whatever. There could be the sense of if there's a specific risk that you ignore, then you're not being wise or discerning. Now, what do you think about that?
I mean, it seems reasonable. I guess my pushback on it would just be, it doesn't necessarily seem biblical to me.
Mm-hmm.
It seems logical, but I just can't see Jesus being like, well, you should wait. You know what I mean? Like, I can't see him just giving pause and being like, well, you could help this guy, but you also might get hurt. So maybe you know what I mean? It just doesn't seem that way, which is probably a terrible argument to counter it. It doesn't seem in line with the biblical ethic to me, just the concern for personal safety, especially as a hindrance from helping those in need.
Mm-hmm. Well, something that I was thinking of, if we go back to the idea of loving the foreigner as yourself, then I think we should think not only about the risk to ourselves, but also we have to think about the risk of harm to the refugee.
Yeah.
The risk of harm to the Muslim who's trying to flee the radical Muslim.
Yeah.
We could even accept that, let's say that welcoming more refugees does increase the chance of, that small percentage being radicalized and, causing terror attacks in the United States. What if we accept that as a genuine risk, but also at the same time consider that we are decreasing the risk of harm to all those who are suffering in a refugee camp? That's a guaranteed reduced risk for them if they are able to come to our country.
Yeah.
I think that's something you have to consider.
So I'd love to put flesh on this real quick. Cardin, in your interview, talked a little bit about the war that actually destroyed his home. So let's play a clip of that real quick, because I think it's a lot easier to make this sort of decision about your safety versus my safety when it's abstract. But when you start hearing from actual people who actually experience war, it kind of makes you take a step back and go, oh shoot. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We don't go back. We try not to go back to it because it's hurtful. It hurts, but it happened. So you go back to it. Wars are terrible. Because you can be in a war. You could be walking, running, fleeing from people, and people behind you are dying. So you don't turn back. Keep running. Keep going forward. So keep going forward. One story my mom told me was, in a war, some soldiers stopped people. Like I was 5 days. They stopped people in front of her. They killed them, 5 people. They killed them. Then, I don't believe it's an accident. I believe that God protected my mother. Because if you have a five-day-old, the kid is 5. In a lot of noise, they're gonna start, the most obvious thing is they're going to start crying. But my mom said, I don't cry. I didn't cry. And my mom took me and her, jumped into those, lay down with those dead people, and covered herself with them. And she said she spent the next night with them until the soldiers left, because they're looking for more people to kill. She said, I spent the whole night with those dead people. And she said, with God's grace, you didn't cry. I said, okay. I said, okay. But I said, oh. Huh. She said, you didn't, yeah. I said, well. But it was crazy. Yeah. Yep. But yeah. That's a war. Wars are terrible. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, Cardin, my friend, he's a little bit younger than me, and I knew he was a refugee, but, you know, for the most part, he seems like a normal Americanized kid. I didn't, until I had him share a story with me, and thank you, Cardin, for doing this, I didn't know he'd been through so much.
Yeah.
So much horror and devastation. It's just like, wow.
Yeah, and when you hear a story like that, that's so, it's so terrible, it almost seems unreal. It makes the risk we take on seem like less a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It just makes it more approachable.
Yeah. It's something else that's cool. We didn't catch this in the interview, but Cardin became a Christian. Well, here in America, through the influence of Christians that reached out to his family while he was here. And I've heard some other stories of that as well.
And we'll post, it's like a 25-minute interview. We'll post the full interview online for you guys to see. But he talks about being in St. Louis and the first people that really like connect with them and love them and serve them are Christian folk from a church who helped their family get settled in. And I just thought, man, that was just beautiful. It was just that was beautiful to
me. And that's something that I think we shouldn't forget about. You know, the opportunity for people to come to a nation with so many Christians in it. If as Christians we believe that salvation is the most important thing in this life, then we should be willing to, you know, make significant sacrifices to, you know, increase that opportunity for as many as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
What do you think about the idea that the government has the responsibility to protect us?
I don't know what I think about that. I really don't know what I think about that. Obviously, you can go to the scriptural idea, right, that the government holds the sword, right, and that authority keeps people in line and those things, but you know, when we were in preparation for this and we were doing our studying in our different areas and those things, one of the things that I found that stood out to me as really intriguing is this idea that nowhere in the New Testament is there recorded a prayer for safety. And obviously that's something that's very individual, right? Like no individual believer specifically asked God for safety. But when you're talking about overarching authority providing protection, right? So the government protecting us. Obviously, there's no, for the believer, there's no overarching authority above God, right? And so you would think if part of the duty of the overarching authority is to provide for safety, that people would bring that to God, and yet they don't. And obviously you can interpret that a couple different ways. People, some theologians would look at that and say that Christians don't, the early Christians didn't pray for God's safety because it was assumed that he was their provider. But at the same time, like, they were going through some pretty terrible stuff and experiencing a lot of pain and suffering and didn't feel the need to ask God to protect them and keep them from that, which I think is, I think that's interesting when we start thinking about who guards our safety and whether or not that's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I wonder if we sometimes overstate what that passage is actually talking about. You know, where it talks about the government has the authority to punish wrongdoers when they do evil.
Yeah.
But doesn't necessarily have the authority to try to prevent all wrongdoing before it happens. You know, if you're applying that to refugees and you said, you know, well, obviously if we have evidence that someone is a terrorist, we won't let them in. If we don't have any evidence, yeah, we can't know for sure that they are never going to commit a crime. But if they haven't committed any crime yet, and there's no indication that they will do so, then is that unknown factor alone reason to reject them, even based on that government authority?
Yeah. So can we play the John Oliver clip here? Because I think this is good.
Okay.
You know John Oliver is the Last Week Tonight news guy?
Yeah, or whatever. That liberal newsman talker person?
I mean, so he does one of the satirical kind of funny news shows, right? But he did a bit a while back. It was right after the terror attack in Paris. He did a bit where he was talking about refugees in the United States and the process we do of vetting. And he talks specifically about this whole gambit, right, of how we protect our safety as Americans and what the risk is in bringing in refugees and those things. And he does a really good job of not only just exposing some light on what the American vetting process is, but also talking through really practically the actual risk involved, this whole idea, right? Like what you're talking about of, well, if they didn't do a crime, how are we supposed to predict whether or not they will do a crime? Like that whole piece. So let me play this real quick, and then I want to hear your thoughts on it, Josh.
In fact, there was only one time in American history when the fear of refugees wiping everyone out did actually come true, and we'll all be sitting around a table celebrating it on Thursday. And look, it is absolutely fair. It's fair to be concerned about safety in the wake of these attacks, and it's fair to wonder who we're letting in and what sort of screening system is in place. Unfortunately, many of the people talking about it this week don't seem to have the first idea of what we're doing.
Do we know who these people are? No. Are they properly vetted? No.
How do you vet them? There's no possible way to vet them.
There's virtually no vetting because there are no databases in Syria. There are no government records. We don't know who these people are.
Look, it is difficult to vet people coming out of a war zone, but it's not like we're just letting anyone in. We are the United States of America, not Arizona State. Because for the record here, let me walk you through what our screening process actually is. If you're a refugee, first, you apply through the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which collects documents and performs interviews. Incidentally, less than 1% of refugees worldwide end up being recommended for resettlement. But if you're one of them, you may then be referred to the State Department to begin the vetting process. At this point, more information is collected. You'll be put through security screenings by the National Counterterrorism Center, the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security. And if you're a Syrian refugee, you'll get an additional layer of screening called the Syria Enhanced Review, which may include a further check by a special part of Homeland Security, the USCIS Fraud Detection and National Security Directorate. And don't relax yet, because we've barely even started. Then you finally get an interview with USCIS officers, and you'll also be fingerprinted so your prints can be run through the biometric databases of the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Defense. And if you make it through all that, you'll then have health screenings, which, let's face it, may not go too well for you, because you may have given yourself a stroke getting through this process so far. But if everything comes back clear, you'll be enrolled in cultural orientation classes, all while your information continues to be checked recurrently against terrorist databases to make sure that no new information comes in that wasn't caught before. All of that has to happen before you get near a plane. This process typically takes 18 to 24 months once you've been referred by the UN to the United States. This is the most rigorous vetting anyone has to face before entering this country. No terrorist in their right mind would choose this path when the visa process requires far less effort. But nevertheless, the House still voted on Thursday to add a few more steps.
The House voted 289 to 137 for tougher screening procedures, requiring the FBI director to sign off on each and every refugee.
He signs off? That is ridiculous. At this point, why don't we just include a pie-eating contest, a spelling bee, and an evening wear portion? But the really hard truth here is no one can promise that someone dangerous still might not slip through. And while that risk should not be denied, it also should not be wildly inflated.
Let me ask this. If you bought a five-pound bag of peanuts and you knew that in the five-pound bag of peanuts right. there were about 10 peanuts that were deadly poisonous, would you feed them to your kids? The answer is no.
Yeah, of course it's no. For a start, you should give your kids an actual meal, not a handful of peanuts, because they're human children, not circus elephants. But second, we wanted to do the math on what he just said. So we bought 5 pounds of peanuts, and we counted them. There are about 1,000 nuts in there. So if 10 of them are poisoned, Mike Huckabee is essentially suggesting that about one of every 100 refugees is a terrorist. But in reality, of the more than 784,000 refugees admitted to the US since 9/11, only 3 have been arrested for planning terrorist activities, none of which, by the way, resulted in attacks here. So the actual known ratio of arrested terror suspects to refugees is not 1 in 100, it's 1 in roughly 261,000. Peanuts themselves have killed far more people in the last decade than terrorist refugees. I'll go one step further. Men named Mike have killed more people than terrorist refugees.
So what do you think about that one, Josh?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are unaware about the details of the vetting process that exists.
And that's why I benefited from that, actually, was to hear him walk through the process like that. It was pretty intense.
Yeah, I've read things that, you know, there's, you know, it's a very selective process. And so I've read, you know, there's people that don't have documentation that, you know, aren't allowed through because of that, or there's people that, you know, fail certain steps of the interview process for various reasons that even, you know, there may be nothing wrong with them, but just because of how selective it is, there's many that don't pass because of that.
That was one of the things Cardin talked about, is one of his sisters didn't pass her interviews and didn't get to come.
Yeah, and I asked him more to elaborate on that. He said, you know, she was married with this other family, and, you know, I guess some of them didn't pass for various reasons or whatever.
Yeah.
And lost my train of thought again.
I keep interrupting you.
Yeah, that's what it is. You keep interrupting me. Now, you know, I would understand if someone might say, you know, okay, you know, you can read this whole list of acronyms of different agencies that check them out, but if we don't have anything or know anything about them, we, you know, what's there to check? We can't guarantee about them. And, you know, I would say that's, you know, that's true. We can't guarantee. And that's part of these risks that we're talking about. We can guarantee that we can provide a better life and opportunity for a large number of people. And I think that's something you have to consider.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to consider the cautionary perspective from a different lens, see what you think about this. What if we didn't look at it through a lens of fear or protecting the country? What if we looked at it through a lens of oppression, where you want to you know, rescue people from oppression, but you have a perception of Islam as having, you know, certain issues with it, where in certain societies, women are oppressed and there's, you know, different things going on like that. You read stories about Muslim immigrants committing rapes in Europe, different crimes like that. and you have this concern that if too much of a percentage of Muslims immigrate to America, that some of this oppression will follow and that people will be oppressed because of it. And that's something you'd be concerned about.
I get that. Yeah, that makes sense. And in fact, hearing especially like some of the reports coming out of Germany and France about just like the increased violent crime and increased rape and those things surrounding some of their refugee communities, that's been some of, I think, maybe the hardest argument for me to wrap my head around, because there is, I mean, yeah, that's terrible. Obviously, we don't want to support or encourage that sort of thing. But in the same breath, I look at it and I go, it's not like we live in this wonderful oppression-free country. You know what I mean? I mean, we have, you know, huge problems with violence in our cities, and we have oppressive structures where corporate entities get to press the crap out of people all the time. And so it seems mildly hypocritical to grab a hold of one, like one particular flavor of oppression and go, well, we can't risk exposing our people to that, but we'll let them be exposed to all the kinds that are already here. And that might be naive of me to say it that way, but it just, it doesn't seem like a weighty enough argument to me, I guess.
I think it's easy to overstate risks like that, especially if you don't personally know any Muslims, and are just reading things on the internet.
Yes, absolutely.
We do have a remarkable history in this country of overstating risks of new waves of immigrants. I was looking up this quote from Benjamin Franklin talking about these swarthy Germans and complaining about that Pennsylvania was founded by the English and it's going to become a colony of aliens who will be so numerous as to Germanize us instead of our Anglifying them, and they will never adopt our language or customs any more than they can acquire our complexion.
Wait. Complexion?
Yeah. Yeah, he goes on and talks about how there's a small number of purely white people, and how the Spaniards and Italians and Swedes have a swarthy complexion. Yeah, it, like...
Ben Franklin, what the heck were you smoking?
And, you know, we
whatever it was probably really good, knowing Ben.
We have a history of overstating risks. Probably due partially to that, you know, sinful nature, heart of trying to turn towards our own groups. And
I think you're just offended by that because he made fun of the Swedes.
And yet we have a history of you know, everyone ends up being assimilated into the melting pot of America. So then we can all get upset about the next group.
Yeah.
And there's also evidence that a lot of the risks, even currently regarding Islam, are overstated. Some of the stories end up being exaggerated or rumors. There's stories about Sharia law coming to Dearborn, Michigan. And I'm open to being corrected on any of this. And, you know, I'm not an expert. I'm willing to accept any evidence that is there. What stuff I've looked into, it's like super exaggerated, and there's like nothing of the sort going on. Like there's an article about a prom in Dearborn, or it might have been a similar city, where they had a girls only prom to accommodate the large percentage of Muslim residents, because I guess they couldn't go to prom with boys, and they had, you know, a special Muslim prayer time in the middle of it and different things, and while also listening to secular music and all this stuff. And so
I thought you were going to say contemporary Muslim music.
So I mean, I understand you could have some legitimate concerns about, you know, religious preference for, you know, oh, the public schools won't let Christians do stuff, but they'll let Muslims have a special prom and prayers and everything. I understand, you know, some concerns about religious preference there and everything. At the same time, I look at that and I'm like, they want to have an American prom. Like,
yeah.
That sounds like they're being pretty Americanized.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, I do want to acknowledge, like, legitimate concerns, different parts of the world, different types of oppression, I think that's absolutely good to be concerned about and try to look at, you know, what's true, what are the details of these things. I think we also have to remember that we have a tendency to overstate risks, especially when we don't personally know people and don't have a connection. And just to try to keep that in mind.
Yeah.
As we, you know, consider what it means to love the foreigner as ourselves.
So as we wrap up this discussion, I want to say two things. The first one is this. Obviously, we covered an insane amount of material in a relatively short time. And so if you feel like we didn't represent a viewpoint or a thought or an argument well, please call us on that.
I feel like that.
Yeah. You can contact us at pbrcast@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter. Use the hashtag pbrcast. We would love to address, come back to anything you guys think we didn't represent well. But the second thing is this. You know, I feel like if you're coming at this discussion from the perspective of a believer, and I know not all of our listeners are believers, but if you're coming at this discussion from the perspective of a Christian believer, then no matter where you land on it, you have to reconcile the idea that Jesus calls us to love our neighbor and to love those who are hurting and to serve and help those who are hurting. And so one of the things I would love to say, just kind of as like kind of the way to end this discussion out, is I would encourage all of you who are those of you who are wrestling with this idea and thinking through those questions of government policy and safety and risk management and all those things, and those of you who are totally settled and know, like, I know exactly what I think about this and here's why, I would encourage all of you to actually spend some time with a refugee family.
Yeah.
Find someone in your area. Like, there are Christian ministries in pretty much every major city that's accepting refugees that can help connect you with the refugee family who actually needs help and is actually glad to be here and is actually trying to adjust.
For St. Louis, go to goodneighborstl.com.
Yeah, that's the Good Neighbor Initiative, which is through Oasis International.
They're connected with it, yeah.
Yeah. But seriously, Google Good Neighbor Initiative, goodneighborstl.com.
Mm-hmm.
Such a cool ministry that connects you with refugee families here in St. Louis who are, I mean, like we heard from Cardin, they're here and they're like, I have no idea, you know, what's going on or how this world works, but I'm glad to be here. And spend some time with some real human beings and hear their story and humanize this political issue a little bit.
Yeah. And it's like a win-win-win. Like, if you're all about helping refugees, then obviously it's a win for you. It's a win for the family. And even like if you have concerns about, you know, how well a family will assimilate and integrate into America, well, you can help them assimilate. You can help them have a better transition into becoming an American by directly interacting with them. And I also want to say that I think it's easy to look at some of these issues as we are people that can help people and we're going to help the helpers. Or, I mean, we're going to be the helpers and help these people that need help. I think one of the foundational aspects of even when Jesus is telling the story of the Good Samaritan and elevating the view of the Samaritan to have a more positive view, and, you know, the whole idea of love the foreigner as yourself, is the idea that we all need to learn from each other, and we all have so much to learn and teach each other. And it's not just about this one way transaction of we're trying to help some people that need help. It's about the heart of God to bring all tribes and tongues and nations together and learn from each other and kind of just illustrate the heart of God through our personal relationships.
Absolutely. So to end out our discussion, we're going to talk about our thing of the week, but before we do that, let's hear one little last quick thing from Cardin talking about some of the benefits of being in American culture for him.
And I can't believe I was going to finish sixth grade. No, that's not a joke. I knew I was going to finish sixth grade. I knew I was not going to finish sixth grade because they had shut down the schools. I was not going to go back to school. So I think I was finished. I was in the fifth grade. But here I got to go to college. That I was the first one in the family to go. Probably not the last. I hope not the last. The first one. So, yeah. Yep. Is that it?
So, I do want to say, I want to talk about our thing of the week real quick. And
sound effect.
What's that?
Sound effect.
What's the sound effect?
For the thing of the week.
Oh, what were we going to do? What was it?
Last time it was the really annoying air horn.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Oh, not that. No, not the siren.
Dang it. Guys, it's time for our thing of the week. Dang it.
Did you remove it?
Put guys, it on it's the time for place? Our thing of the week.
Thing of the week.
Yeah, so, oh my gosh. That was one of the worst transitions ever. So I want to talk about this real quick, coming out of our discussion on faith healing. I meant to talk about this in the last episode, and I just forgot. I think I even had it in our notes. But there's
just super professional like that.
Yeah, there's a video game called That Dragon Cancer. Have you heard of this, Josh, or just from me?
Just from you, Sam.
Oh, man, Josh. You gotta play it.
Sam, you're the gamer nerd, and I'm the, like, book nerd.
Yeah, but you need to play this game. It's so good. So, to even call it a video game is kind of weird, right? So, it's, especially if you're not a gamer person, it's technically a video game, but it's probably closer to what a lot of people would call, like, an interactive story or an interactive novel. Essentially, you are walking through the scenes of this family losing their child to cancer. And it is, I mean, oh my gosh, Josh, it is like gut-wrenchingly painful to watch. And everything is done really artistically and like cinematically and dramatically. And you walk through these different scenes that are different aspects of the story. And literally, like, it's on like iPad and also on consoles and computers and those things. So you, if you're listening, you should download this game and you should play it, because it's an incredibly powerful experience, and it draws you into the emotional loss that goes with suffering and illness and those things. But there's a couple scenes. Like there's a scene where the parents are sitting in the doctor's waiting or in the doctor's office while the doctor is explaining that the cancer is terminal, that the boy's going to die, and while the doctor is explaining it, it starts raining in the room and like water slowly fills up. And then like you see the dad, like you're hearing the dad's inner monologue, like while he's hearing this. And then all of a sudden he just starts drowning in the room, like while the doctor and the nurse and everyone are discussing treatment and care for the child. And there's a scene where, so both the parents are believers, and this is why I brought it up. This is why I thought it was cool for our faith healing discussion is, both the parents are believers, and as you walk through the game, you see them essentially having two different reactions to this. And so the dad, it essentially crushes his faith. And this analogy of just drowning follows the dad throughout the story, where he's just like, how do I handle this? How can God be good if my child dies of cancer? And then alongside that, you have the mom who is so like blindingly confident that God is going to supernaturally heal her son. And so you get a window into some of her prayers and like some of her prayer journals as she's writing down like, God, I can't wait for you to heal my son. And then like for that to be this display to everyone around us of how good you are and how you show up. And it's such an intense dichotomy. And in terms of like drawing you in, the most powerful scene of the whole game, and this isn't a spoiler because, I mean, it's a very short thing, but the most powerful scene of the whole game, literally, Kim and I played through it together. I had to step away and walk away during this part. It was so gut-wrenchingly painful to experience. There's a scene where it puts you inside the dad, and you're sitting in the hospital room with the son, and he's crying out in pain. It's like right near the end of his life. And there's all these different things you can do in the room to try and soothe him. And so you try and give him juice and you try and give him a blanket and you try and rock him, and nothing works. And the whole time you're getting audio of this little boy just crying out in pain and like begging his dad to help him. Like right now, even like talking about it, I can't handle it. But it's so gut-wrenchingly painful to be in that moment and to experience the suffering of this child and the helplessness of his father to actually engage him, to actually help soothe the pain. And there's a culmination in the game. This is a spoiler, so you should skip this if you... Actually, you shouldn't. You shouldn't worry about it. You should play it anyway. It culminates in this scene where you're in a church, and it shows... essentially, you're like lighting these prayer candles, kind of like an Orthodox church. And as you light one, you'll hear audio of an actual person praying for the boy. And so you have to light all the candles, and there's this cacophony of prayers of people coming to God and asking God to heal this boy. And when you get them all lit up, it like lights up the room, and you can see his outline in the back of the sanctuary. And then there's this moment where all the prayers are cut off and the candles are snuffed out, and the boy dies. And it's like, I mean, it's intense in the moment, but it's this beautiful experiential picture of loss, but also what we talked about in our last podcast of a theology of suffering, of how God makes his gospel known in the midst of loss, in the midst of suffering. I mean, it's a stinking powerful experience. I don't want to talk about everything in it because there's a whole bunch of other stuff in it that's really good, but you should absolutely check it out, especially if you are interested in our discussions over the last couple episodes about healing and a theology surrounding loss and suffering and those things. I don't think I've ever experienced, outside of actual loss and suffering in my own life, I don't think I've ever experienced through books or reading or devotion or anything as powerful of an empathetic experience of a real theology of loss as playing that video game. So... it's really good.
That Dragon Cancer.
That Dragon Cancer. You should check it out.
Wow.
We got anything else, man?
I don't think we got anything else. I think I'm going to go study the Quran because I'm a heretic.
That's my line. I'm gonna go read a Mark Driscoll book because I'm a heretic. I will...
Wait, we can't both be heretics.
Oh, we are. Now the podcast is in trouble.